The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This is the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Welcome to the podcast. Today's episode is all about the power of collective action and the steely determination to bring plays to life. We delve into the remarkable story of 13P, a collective of 13 New York City playwrights who came together to produce 13 plays on their own terms. Born out of an idea from visionary founding member Rob Handel during the summer of 2002 at the O'Neill Playwrights Conference.
I was trying to think, how can I get into a less powerless position as a playwright? Or how could we as American playwrights be in a position that made us less frustrated and angry, because anger doesn't really do anything that helps us or helps our plays? And what would be the alternative to that? How could this anger be turned into a force for good? And I thought of the idea of creating an organization which would produce plays very inexpensively, sort of on the same level as some of the companies that inspired us in the off-Broadway world, and that the playwrights would be in charge and take control of our own destinies by producing the plays ourselves.
Rob saw a way in which playwrights could unite with a clear mission to bring their unique plays to the stage, escaping the endless development cycle.
We don't develop plays, we do them. It's so simple.
Fellow member Sarah Rule there with 13P's mantra, so beautiful in its simplicity and focus. By pooling their resources and talents, these playwrights created a dynamic and supportive community that empowered them to take control of their artistic destinies. And over the next decade, they successfully staged 13 plays, fulfilling their mission before taking the brave decision to implode in 2012. 13P was composed of Sheila Callahan, Erin Courtney, Madeline George, Rob Handel, Anne-Marie Healy, Julia Jarrico, Young-Jean Lee, Winter Miller, Sarah Rule, Katie Ryan, Lucy Thurber, Anne Washburn and Gary Winter. In this episode, I'm excited to bring you my conversations with Winter Miller and Madeline George, discovering how 13P helped to reframe or reroute the road to production, proving that with collective effort and vision, anything is possible. This episode, I think, is significant, as it was the story of 13P that inspired me to create this third series of the podcast, focusing on how we can proactively create opportunities for ourselves rather than waiting for them to come along. Less time in development, more time in the theatre. In the name of transparency, my conversations with Winter and Madeline were recorded separately on two different calls. This episode has been cut together to focus on the central topic.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast with Paul Kalbergi.
All right, let's dive in. Madeline George is an award-winning playwright and founding member of the Obie-winning collective 13P. She holds a BA from Cornell University and an MFA from NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. Madeline's plays include the Obie Award-winning Hurricane Diane, the Pulitzer Prize finalist The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence, and Seven Homeless Mammoths Wander New England, a Susan Smith Blackburn finalist. Other honours include the Princess Grace Award, the Hermitage Major Theatre Award, and a Lily Award. Her work often explores themes of technology, relationships, and societal change, blending humour and insight to provoke thought and conversation. Madeline has written for FX and HBO and is a producer, writer, and executive story editor on the HBO Emmy and Golden Globe nominated mystery comedy Only Murders in the Building. Fellow 13P member Winter Miller is an acclaimed playwright and journalist with a degree from Smith College and a master's in playwriting from Columbia University. Winter's plays, including The Powerful in Darfur, have been developed and performed at prestigious venues such as the Public Theatre and the Guthrie. Her work often addresses pressing social issues, boldly aiming to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I love that. In 2019, Winter Miller wrote, produced and directed No One Is Forgotten, which premiered at Rattlestick Theatre in New York City to rave reviews and sold out houses, an endeavour that exemplifies her commitment to the spirit of 13P. In addition to her playwriting, Winter has an extensive background in journalism, having written over 70 articles for the New York Times, as well as New York Magazine and other notable publications. She's also taught playwriting at institutions including Columbia University and the New School.
Coming up,
people had to have the right mix of like irritation and ambition and willingness to sort of throw their lot in with other people as a way of breaking through what felt like, you know, just an insuperable barrier to full production at that time.
The invitation was, do the play that you don't think anyone else is going to produce. What a great invitation. Most theater companies aren't going to, you know, offer you that.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
Winter, it's great to have you here. How are you doing?
Hello, thank you for having me here. I'm excited.
Hey, Madeline, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Yeah, I'm so happy to. It's pouring rain here. There's a flood watch. I'm not going anywhere. I couldn't be happier than to do this.
Maybe if you can talk a little about your playwriting journey before 13P, where you were in your career and what opportunities or lack thereof did you see at the time? What it was that motivated you to pursue unconventional or non-traditional routes to the stage?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I have a little bit of an unusual story in that I was a teen playwright. So I was in the Young Playwrights Festival when I was, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. And that was formative for me, fantastic, and really quite deforming in terms of like setting appropriate expectations for, right, for a lifelong career. I was like, oh, I see. So I just like, you know, dash this one act play off. And then soon, you know, celebrity actors are in it. And I'm living in a vacated loft in Chelsea, eating muffins and watching Beavis and Butthead with other young prodigies. So it didn't prove to be that way. Once I was out of that tiny little specialized bracket. And I came to New York right away after I graduated from college. I went to NYU. I was like, I got to just like, you know, like motor through my graduate degree. That's how I'll get into the scene in New York. And I did meet extraordinary people at NYU, but I was like, it wasn't like the scene was like delighted to see me. And so very quickly I was like, oh, this version of being a teenage, you know, phenom is just not going to translate. And that was the beginning of more than a decade of me not being able to get my work done. And it wasn't necessary. There's never a reason, right, why your play isn't done. There's never a reason. You can never say it's because of who I am or the subject matter or the length or the whatever, the cast size. It's always ineffable. It's not a meritocracy. And certainly in the US, in New York City, it's a little bit of an economy of scarcity. People are really right, competing for these, you know, to make it through these kept gates. And so at that time, in particular, in the early 2000s, I feel like there was just an incredible paucity of any kind of second stage, you know, black box or experimental or first draft kind of spaces at the larger theater institutions. You could rent a dripping mouse infested warehouse and put your play on, but it wasn't like there was a second. So there were, and there, this was kind of a known problem that playwrights who were up and coming could get readings, but no more.
Right.
And I started to really notice this effect that it was having on my playwriting. A lot of my plays had, they were like radio plays, you know, I wasn't growing as a playwright because my plays were never being done in time, space, and material dimension.
Right.
And I started to notice that like I had characters that were immobilized who, you know, through whom voices came like channels. I didn't understand my scripts would almost like had cuts in them. Do you know what I mean? Where it was like smash to, you know, I was just like only hearing when I had the luck of having a staged reading. Yes. All I was getting was a staged reading.
I was very new to playwriting at that time. I entered grad school in 2000 and graduated in 2003. So I didn't have a sense of what the landscape was like at all. You know, I went to plays and all of that, but I didn't really have a sense of who the gatekeepers were or how people got their plays produced. I had done very little research because I had initially wanted to pursue acting. I didn't have a lifelong dream of being a playwright, and I hadn't been, you know, nurtured to be a playwright.
So was there a sense from the more established playwrights around you at the time that doors were closed and opportunities were lacking? I guess that the idea for 13P was born out of frustration.
Yes, I realized it as soon as we had meetings when they said what the mission was. You know, early on, you know, Rob had said, like, aren't you tired of the gatekeepers? And the and everyone was like, oh, developmental reading after developmental reading. And I had not encountered that yet. And I thought, well, that sucks. You know, but I didn't know it in my bones. I would come to know it. And I would certainly hear that reflected from most of the playwrights that I knew, you know, just development hell. But I didn't, you know, I was newer in my journey.
Could you talk a little about the formation and how you guys came together?
I was a script intern at the O'Neill Playwright Center in Connecticut, which is where Madeline and Rob and Julia Jarko were all there that summer, along with other wonderful playwrights, workshopping their plays.
One of the sort of like meccas of staged readings in the US is famously the O'Neill Playwrights Conference. And I was very lucky to get to go there the summer of 2002. And one of the other writers who was there was Rob Handel. And we were both like, we couldn't believe our luck that we were at this, you know, extremely exciting sort of summit of staged readings. And yet we were so conscious of the fact that this was also kind of like the best we could hope for. Like very unlikely, it was very unlikely that our plays would move to a fully realized production after this.
I was just listening to everyone and just everything was new to me, all of it. I'd not been in an environment quite like this. I just didn't know. It was the summer after my second year of grad school, and I just loved all of it. I loved the people. I loved Madeline, Rob, Julia. Like I was just, you know, every day was like, it was like summer camp, but I was for the first time meeting a community of theater people that I wanted to work with.
Rob was just like A, extremely practical and witty, B, a seasoned arts professional. And he was just like, we could do better than this. Like we could get people together. We could pool our collective resources and we could do our own shows, you know? And I was like very inspired by him. He was moving to New York. I knew a bunch of people already there. And I was like, why don't we put out the call? And we, you know, reached out to a number of playwrights that we mutually knew or that we each knew.
I was super lucky. There's no other word for it. Like right place, right time. I happened to be there. They contacted me and were like, this is, we're going to do this thing. It was unnamed. Are you interested in being a part of it? And I was like, absolutely. No one had ever invited me to be a part of anything as, you know, as not as a playwright. So I was like, yeah, like hang out with cool people. Absolutely. Why would I possibly say no? Of course. Like, yeah. What does this mean? And it's not, you know, I didn't have any money to throw around. So it didn't seem like it was a risk. It seemed like more like an impossibility.
Okay.
Like I sort of thought maybe a bunch of people would get together and then what would happen?
So you put out the call and I guess it resonates, right? Everybody who replied was feeling the same thing and kind of on board for the same journey.
Exactly. People had to have the right mix of like irritation and ambition and willingness to sort of throw their lot in with other people as a way of breaking through what felt like, you know, just an insuperable barrier to full production at that time.
And this was from a mix of early and mid-career playwrights.
Yeah.
You had writers at varying stages involved.
We did. I mean, I think it proved to be like very good for us to have people who were, we had some folks who were like, who had never even had a reading. And we had some folks who were, you know, pretty far along in their career. I guess the furthest along at the time that we came together might've been Sarah Rule, whose plays The Clean House and Eurydice Lost had some success. And then there were lots of other, I mean, everybody in the group is fantastic and I love them all, but Anne Washburn and Sheila Callahan and Young Jean Lee also had some stature. Mm.
Some of the names that were coming in were people that I knew, specifically Lucy Thurber. And Lucy had been a mentor to me. We met still while I was in grad school a little earlier in a Tina Howe workshop.
And these are all writers who have, you know, gone on to continue to make a career, to forge careers in writing and in the arts and in entertainment. So
in terms of where you all were geographically, obviously you and Rob had met at the O'Neill. He was moving to New York. Was everybody else already New York based at that point?
Everybody was New York based. And in fact, I feel like this was the sort of, we didn't have stringent or rigorous criteria. We were like, who do we know? Who do we like? Whose plays do we want to help put on? And who can come to meetings?
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
And I mean, everyone was so smart. And certainly the core folks were very determined and met consistently and didn't drop the ball. I mean, I'm very, very grateful to 13P and to that core group in particular for providing all of us an opportunity to have a collective, but also to put our work into the world.
Yeah.
In the end, 11 others besides us showed up at this first meeting, and that's how we became 13P.
So was there a moment when you sat down and agreed on a collective mission, or was it more you and Rob presenting the mission to the other writers?
I mean, I think there were a couple of sort of things that we knew in advance. Like, we knew that we wanted the playwright to be the artistic director of the company while their show was up. In other words, to not just to, you know, sort of thumb our nose at the institutional inertia, you know, and not just to learn from seeing our shows up, but also to learn about the exigencies of production and to make decisions and to be where the person with whom the buck stopped about decisions and learn about institutions that way, but also learn about our own values as artists that way. And so we wanted that to be the case. And we knew that we didn't want there to be a chore wheel, you know what I mean? And that we didn't want it to be that kind of actual socialist collective.
The invitation was, you know, do the play that you don't think anyone else is going to produce.
Yeah.
What a great invitation. Most theater companies aren't going to offer you that. Or if they are, it's because you've already built up, you know, some kind of a name and following that they think it's, you know, low risk.
We never expected, and this is really different from some other collectives who have come, you know, who predated us and who have come since. We never expected everybody to do the equal kind of share of the work. Rob and I always knew that we were like, okay, well, we're really, you know, we're sticking our necks out and we're going to put our money where our mouth is and we're going to do a lot of the work. Particularly Rob is like, I will raise the money that we need. We, you know, with the help of everybody, which is for a lot of us, that's the biggest thing.
That's
the hurdle. How are we going to get all this money together, you know, to do this?
Yeah.
I didn't know that the brains behind the operation were going to be so brainy. Mm. And it was a really cool thing because people in the group were not on the hook to do more than they could do, except for the people. Like, I really feel like Rob and Madeline and Anne and Gary Winter were the engine. But one of the things that they did as leaders was, I think, to ask us, like, what could we bring to the table?
Yeah.
You know, and like, what were we good at? And I had no sense of fundraising and I was pretty new to the industry. So I knew some people, but not many.
Yeah.
I really knew very few playwrights and stuff.
I love the idea of creative currency, though. Come with what you have, bring what you have to the table, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a potluck dinner.
It really was that. And, you know, in later years, it functioned as someone would say, you know, I'm casting my show. Does anybody have, and they would give a character description. Mm. And then we would, you know, we would all chime in with our suggestions and contact info. Like, it was like a bank that instead of being one brain had all of us. And that was incredibly useful to just be able to turn to the group and say, you know, what about this? Or, you know, or to have people say, I worked with so-and-so and they are wonderful, you know?
Yeah.
But I also think like some collectives function much more like socially like a collective. And then they pitch in and sort of meaningfully equitable ways into producing the shows. We didn't expect that because we knew that like, you know, some people are just on different trajectories. I mean, Sarah was so successful that she put in early to be the last playwright because she was busy. And also people had kids, you know, everybody knew that they were, you know, we knew that different people had different capacity and we wanted to make that, build that in instead of trying to beat it out of people and like demand that they, you know, show up for things that we knew they never would.
Yeah. But also in terms of the equity that you bring, you know, a playwright who'd enjoyed, I guess, more success at that point would have brought with them an audience. So there's a different kind of equity or contribution to the pool in terms of marketing the show. You know, hey, we've got so-and-so involved.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's precisely it. We were so pleased to have, you know, I think having never had a full production beyond my juvenilia, I was like, I want to put my sweat equity into this. Mm. You know, this is good for me. And it's also a way for me to feel like I'm in the theater.
Yes.
You know, even as my plays are not getting chosen, I'm doing this thing that is, even though like the thing I ended up really doing the most was box office, because I happen to like it. I happen to like, you know, knowing who's in the house and like giving a little pre-show speech and stuff. So that's not glamorous, but it did make me feel very materially connected to the to the New York theater scene. And like, it meant a lot to me to put that, to contribute that to the writing of my peers that I admired so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would imagine even beyond your own play, being part of those other 12 plays for that decade long period, that had to have been an inspirational thing to have going on in the background, a driving force for your own work during that period.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. It was so delightful, and it was gratifying. And then we had this sort of sense that our project really met the zeitgeist at the right moment. And people were like, oh yeah, that's right. We should be making it possible for many, many more plays that are from less tested quote-unquote writers to have the chance to be in front of live audiences. And as a result, the Lincoln Center has a second stage, you know, Roundabout developed a second stage, Atlantic, you know, whatever. These are places that matter to New York playwrights and not necessarily to everybody definitely. In the whole wide world.
We touched briefly on Sarah deciding to go last in the run. Could you talk a little about that first kind of coming together and how you decided the order of the plays?
So I lived in Chelsea at the time in like a small one bedroom, but like a railroad type of flat. And we all met in my apartment, but the only place that was sort of large enough to seat us was in my bedroom. So we were all sitting in my bedroom, getting to know each other. I think the only two who weren't there were Young Jean and Sarah Rule. And the way that we decided the order in which we would go was to just put our numbers down on a piece of paper and first, second, third choice, and they would go through it. And, you know,
we literally asked everybody for their top three choices and everybody got either their first or second. So that was also fortunate, I think. But it was like I was saying, it's like some people were like, well, my child is just born, I'd like to have a later slot. Or I know I'm going to be on tour, I'd like to have a later slot. And then other people were like, I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, I got to get this play up.
Anne Washburn had picked one. I had picked two. I didn't want to be the first one to go. But I was worried if I went too late, like, how could we possibly still exist? Right. How would this work? And so I was, you know, just trying to, you know, get in there.
Yeah. Get in there in case the thing lost momentum or whatever.
Or whatever.
I think we were happy to hear that Anne Washburn wanted to go first or wanted to go early with her play, The Internationalist.
Okay.
Because it was such a classic example of a kind of a genius work of art that was so odd on the page that our artistic directors just simply could not get their brain around it. It was this incredible, surreal workplace comedy that takes place, about two-thirds of it is in a made-up foreign language of Anne's own design.
Wow.
In three dimensions, in time and space. Like, it's funny, terrifying, brilliant, amazing. And on the page, I think people, as you can imagine, they would read it, be like, what am I looking at here? And so we were like, this is a brilliant way to kick off, because this show, it needs production and it needs an audience in order to live. And in fact, it was like a big hit for us. And then it transferred to another theater out of town. And then it was remounted by the Vineyard Theater off Broadway. And then we were like, exactly, this is exactly what we mean. Like, once you see these shows, you're going to want these shows.
You know, I didn't know how magnificent of a run it would have, and that people and foundations would want to support the work.
The conversation continues after these messages. The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Just to talk a little bit more about this idea of bringing the piece that you thought nobody else would stage, was that the rationale behind everyone's choice of play?
I think everyone had a different thing that they used the opportunity for. So some people, some people were like, I want to do something that is a little bit site specific, or it's in an atypical venue. I feel like Sheila Callahan's play was an example of that. in the case of Lucy Thurber, her play Monstrosity was this massive galloping epic about a fascist takeover in a dystopian land with like two intermissions and a giant chorus wow. of prep school proto-fascists. I mean, it was like just an incredible piece that no theater would come anywhere near because of its huge demands. Yeah. And we were able to, because Lucy had control of the budget, she was able to say, okay, I have this fixed amount of money. I'm just going to run for 8 nights.
Brilliant.
So instead of it, like by shrinking the runtime, the number of performances, she was able to scale up the performance itself.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that sense, you've got that freedom. You're not tethered to the commercial interests or demands of the theater in its programming or season. You can make that call.
Absolutely. So that's what she wanted it for. I had a play that I had come this close with at a number of theaters and nobody had done it. In fact, it was the play that I was doing the reading of at the O'Neill when I met Rob Handel, you know, 9.5 years later. I was like, I'm going to use my slot to do this play. The play never got produced, therefore it never got finished, you know? And so it was very meaningful to me to be able to do it.
Right.
Even though in a way, by the time almost a decade had gone by, I was sort of grown up past that play. But I just, you know, I'm sure all writers know that feeling where it's like, yes. That thing didn't culminate.
Yeah.
It's not done. It's like it sticks in the back of your head.
You can't
all the
quite
time.
Move on.
Yeah.
I think there are certain stories that we could just have to tell, that have to be told, that can't live in the bottom drawer forever in order to write new work.
That's it. If you can't do the next thing until you fully finish that last thing.
Yeah.
And then I'll just say, like, Sarah Rule's play, which was the 13th play that we did, she was like, I want to take an older play of mine and collaborate with a composer and musicalize it. So these are all versions of like, how can I just do the thing that is most dear to my artistic heart and that doesn't get a lot of institutional like support.
Yeah. Affording each other that space and that stage and that collective support to say, come and do the piece you want to do the way you want to do it.
Yeah.
That's really rare. And I think that's great that you could in that model afford each other that opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. I think that also is where the contact high comes from, that I felt, you know, being close to all of those endeavors, even though I wasn't artistically contributing, sweeping and taking tickets.
Yeah.
Still, it's cool to be near that while that's happening.
So just to talk a little about budget, I guess, obviously, as you guys went on, that increased. But in the beginning, initially, did everyone have the same kind of, you know, size of budget? And the idea was, here it is, do what you will with it, spend it on a chorus or production design, you choose.
That's right. And in fact, that was the principle. And in the beginning, our budget was smaller and it grew a bit by the end, but not by a ton. We never raised that much money. We didn't have to. We didn't need to maintain a space or any kind of, you know, education department or any other kind of overhead. We had our meetings on Thursday mornings at a Starbucks. And so we added a little bit, with the budget grew a little bit over the years, but basically it stayed the same. One line that we kept in it, you know, we had up and coming producers who were themselves in assistant or associate positions at other theaters and wanted the experience. We had them working with us very closely from the beginning so that they could sort of cut their teeth on us. One of them said, you know, this is how my grad school is doing this with you. They've all gone on to just dazzling careers working in institutional theaters. I hope taking with them a certain amount of, you know, respect for this kind of model.
Yeah.
And then we also insisted that all 13 of us pay a professional PR person. Not a ton of money. It wasn't like a boutique firm, but that's the kind of thing that is like worth putting, you know, money into and getting a pro to help you with. Anybody can run the back end of Ovation Ticks and an Excel spreadsheet and welcome people at the door and be like, hello, it's general seating. But that's not true about PR.
Yeah.
You really need to know how to do it. It made a big difference for us because we would have, you know, the most energetic word of mouth for us at the beginning would not have been enough. Mm.
Yeah, for sure. So I know Rob had a background in funding and had been successful in that regard in the past.
Yeah.
Was there any moment when you'd considered pooling resources perhaps to finance the productions if you couldn't secure funding? Were there any other ideas or measures in place?
I don't think we had the money to do that. You know, I think that also, you know, people had different amounts of money and it was very much the sort of promise that I think Rob and I made at the beginning was like, we will take this on and figure out how to make the money. this isn't the only way to do it. It could be done any number of ways.
Yeah.
We had schemes that were really fun to dream up that helped us raise money. Like, we ran this program called the Blind Optimist Package at the beginning, which was, we asked people for what felt like a huge amount of money for us at the time. It might have been $250. I don't know.
Right.
And we were like, if you give us this now, you can have a ticket to every one of our shows. And we had people do that and then come to every one of our shows over the course of 10 years. Boy, we loved them so much. You know? We were, I think, very kind of experimental and creative with fundraising at the beginning. And then we got some pretty useful grants that allowed us to stop having to throw galas and do that kind of heavy lifting for money.
I mean, I haven't been part of a collective on anywhere near the same scale as 13P, but 10 years ago, three other playwrights and I did a 3-week run in London of four short plays, and we self-funded that, each contributing, I think, about £1,000.
That's awesome.
And we arranged a box office split with the venue to avoid upfront costs. So models like that, perhaps on a smaller scale, could be worth playwrights exploring, coming together, pooling a smaller sum of money and putting something on stage together to kind of share the costs.
That sounds brilliant. That sounds exactly right. There's an organization with a rotating membership in New York City called The Pool, and they function on a similar model. There's like seed money that comes in and then people give their own. And I mean, I don't know how many years they've been doing it, but every year, every summer, they have a roster of plays and they run in rep.
Yeah.
So although they're not on the same bill, they're using the same space and sets, which is obviously a huge cost savings.
Yeah, definitely. So for any playwrights listening, considering forming a collective, what would you say to them?
I would say, if you have a collective and you trust the members of the collective, what a great opportunity for several reasons. One, if you can all sort of pool your fundraising, perhaps like if you are buying a press rep as sort of a package deal to rep these three shows, for instance, that's a savings of what you might pay if you're just an individual, or if you're going to have, maybe you're going to have these three plays consecutively, and, you might be able to rent space, share a set, and, that kind of thing. Like, you might cut down on rent and production costs, or just if you were doing, three separate productions at three separate times, you could mentor each other. The person who's gone first could say, this is what I wish I knew, and this is what I wish I'd done differently. Or, who was the best part of my team? I think you should work with so-and-so. That kind of a thing, in the way that a, helpful older sibling might say, oh, this is what I had to go through, but here, this might help you.
I think that, it's great to know how much you can give to the endeavor. And if it's sort of your idea, to have a realistic sense that you might need to drive things and keep the momentum up during the difficult times in a way that may not be equally shared with everybody, but also in the reverse sense, reach out to people who you want to spend a lot of harrowing time with. Make common cause with people that you care about, whether you care about them socially or whether you admire their work or whatever it is. I think that these, like, having a realistic sense of that it will take a lot of yourself to make it work, and then also not lashing yourself to somebody who you have mixed feelings about at the beginning. It's going to be an interpersonal project no matter what, and you're going to want to be in the trenches with people that you can rely on and can respect. Yeah. And then maybe think about what the horizon is of your commitment. And maybe, some collectives operate on a sort of renewal model. So it's like they are going to do this much and then they're going to check back in. Do they want to do another round? Do they want to go another year? Do they want to go another 5 years?
That is
one way to do it so that you don't burn all the way out.
Yeah. Or maybe models like The Welders that keep going by each staging a play and then passing on the baton to the next group of writers and kind of handing the collective on, kind of keeping it going, but with a new team behind it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or maybe it's like you do it and you start it and you get a taste for it and you're like, I do want to build a theater. This is good for me. Turns out I'm good at not just at writing, but also at running something.
Yeah. Okay, there's a key part of the 13P story that we have to talk about. You guys were resolute from the start that once all 13 players had been staged, the collective would cease to exist.
Yeah. We knew that we wanted to do it as a finite project and that we didn't want to actually build an institution, but to build a structure that could stand in opposition to institutions.
I love that. It's brave, it's bold, and it makes perfect sense. It doesn't tether you to roles that you might not want indefinitely, right? There's a clear purpose.
Exactly. Also, in the moments when it became a grind, I was like, okay, well, it's not forever. You know, it's for now.
Yeah.
And I don't have to be like, you know, a drudge in a box office infinity.
Right.
It'll go out in a blaze of glory one day soon.
I mean, it was funny when it was time to implode. I think 12 of the 13 folks were like, yes, let's implode. I think I was the only one who was like, but why? Why? It was so wonderful, you know, not taking into account all of the effort of that core group of people and what they'd done, but with the idea of, could we, you know, this time get hired folks to help with that. And, you know, like now that we had more access to things that we didn't have in the beginning, why make something that worked so brilliantly? Why just let it go? And if we weren't going to do it again ourselves, which I understood by popular sentiment, why wouldn't we pass it on to the next 13 people and let them have the momentum of what our group had built up?
Yeah.
But people really felt strongly of, no, we're doing what we said we're doing. We're doing this and then we're stopping.
It was like a statement.
Yeah, it was wise. It made sense. So I was reluctant to let it go because I was going to miss these people and miss our collective. It felt like being in, you know, like a very, I want to say a gang without all of the implications that a gang would have, but like you had teammates. It felt like we were on a team. And maybe that was why I responded it too much, is that I had played sports and been on teams for most of my life. So
that support network must have been invaluable.
Yeah, it just felt like a bulwark against the sort of cruelties of the industry, or, you know, that you wouldn't feel isolated. You were part of something. You mattered because you were in something that was doing something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being in a collective, it allows you to like rise with each other, you know?
Mm.
So when we were in 13P, like whenever any one of us had another success or another production or a won something or whatever, it funneled back into the collective and made us all stronger. And that is a way to move your own career forward, and B, an antidote to the kind of competitiveness and that scarcity mindset that comes out of just feeling like you're constantly on your knees begging to get your work done.
So what would you say are the biggest lessons or takeaways or discoveries from being part of a collective?
I feel like it helped me believe the true thing, which is that the institutions exist because of us and not the other way around. I think, you know, it's very easy, as we've been talking about, this sort of like, you know, supplicant posture that artists find themselves in all the time. It's very easy to feel like, you know, you are lucky if the institution chooses you.
Mm.
And not to say that one is not lucky if one gets a chance at a production with a lot of resources put behind it. But we always have to remember that theater is immortal and will never die, will never die, but institutions will pass away. Institutions exist because writers write plays and actors perform them and directors direct them, not the other way around. And it's good to have that in your mind, not to go in when you get the opportunity, not to go in there guns a-blazing like a total jerk and like walking around entitled, but just to like remember that like the reason that everybody's there is actually, even if those people might have forgotten and they think that the reason is there is to draw their weekly salary and make contributions to their 401k, the real reason that you're all there is in fact the play that you made. And you can feel good about making asks and calls and even sometimes demands that will allow the play to flourish on its own terms the way that you know it must.
Definitely.
Being its author and not not to feel like you just can never ask for what you need. We can all agree that our focus should be turned towards the play.
Yes.
And we should be devoted to lifting the play up into the place where it needs to be. And that's that 13P was a really pure expression of that value.
Yeah.
I think we served as a template for other groups in other cities who wanted to do something similar. They tended to have more like 3 or 4 playwrights rather than a hefty 13. But I think that part of what was fun was just being in the conversation and sort of, I suppose, like riding the coattails of the entity of 13P.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, people be like, oh, yeah, you're a part of 13P. And I don't know today how many people are aware of who or what 13P was.
All of my students are. Every class that I teach.
Oh, really?
They're all aware. Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. Yeah, I don't have sort of illusions about what lasts. But I suppose, like, you know, 30 years from now, someone could dig up an archive and say, oh, look what existed. Let's try this, in the way that there was, you know, a renewed cafe chino, and, you know, people are always looking for something to breathe life back into. So maybe it will crop up again.
I feel like 13P made a difference. It made a difference in our lives, but it also made a difference to the field. And in a way that liberates me to be like, I really just want to write plays now. I don't want to actually get involved. Like, I don't get my hands dirty in institution building or institution dismantling anymore. You know, I feel like I put in my 12 years and I learned so much, and really like, grounded my artistic character, and it bonded me to those other writers. And I feel like I don't feel bad now, just being like, I want to just go to plays and write them. I don't actually need to, like, you know.
But just knowing that you guys did it,
like,
you proved the concept.
That's right.
You know, so
I forgot. That's probably the most important thing.
It can be done.
Anybody can do it. Absolutely.
Would you consider doing it again?
Although it's really not about age and energy level, I think if I had a play that I couldn't get any uptake on in the world and that I really wanted to put onto a stage, I feel empowered now that I would be able to figure out how to do that.
I just felt like this was an incredible model, and there wasn't an instant in which I had one regret about being a part of it. And to the contrary, you know, every day I just was thankful that I had been invited.
One of the greatest things I ever had the chance to participate in.
What about post-implosion winter? Have you guys kept in touch?
I mean, for a while, a good while, Aaron Courtney and I used to have a two-person playwriting group.
2P.
Yeah, 2P, exactly. We met on Friday mornings in my house. I think she would drop the kids off at school and then come over. And we would either sit and write together, or read our work together, or sometimes I would just make us an omelet and we would sit and eat and just talk about things. But it was like, it was so wonderful and warm, because Aaron is just this absolutely just darling, layered, fierce artist. And so it was really fun. And it felt like we were just sort of, you know, carrying something.
Yeah.
And then Anne and Gary and Madeline became part of something that's now called Still Write.
Okay.
That was silent playwriting retreats.
Right.
That they were organizing with the great playwright and just incredible human Eric N. And so I went on one of those and saw them there. And, you know, I had coffee with Anne Washburn just a few weeks ago. And I bumped into Gary at Tina Howe's memorial. And Lucy and I will, you know, text each other and that kind of thing. I think we just, you know, when we saw each other, I always felt like it was, you know, a nice reunion. And I would go and, you know, try to see everybody's shows that they were doing. And I felt like people were supportive.
Over the course of over 10 years, we never all met in the same room at the same time.
What? Really? That's crazy.
There was always at least one of us missing at every one of our events, including our big implosion party at the end. So
really?
Yeah.
Gosh. Wow. That's crazy. Well, listen, Madeline, that's all my questions.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much for your time.
Awesome.
It's been so wonderful to chat and hear about the story firsthand.
Thanks again. So nice to talk to you.
Winter, I have so enjoyed this.
Thank you for your great questions, and thank you for wanting to talk about playwriting and include more people in the big tent. I respect that and wanted to join you in support of that mission. Talking is so hard.
Thanks for contributing to the conversation. Thanks for sharing the 13P story with us.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Take care.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
Wow, it's fascinating that the group was never together all at the same time in the same place. That definitely explains why I couldn't find a picture of them anywhere online, and I guess why that New York Times article about their implosion features a collection of separate pictures stitched together at the top. If there was ever a reason for a reunion, maybe it's to get a nice picture of the 13 of them together. I can't thank Madeline and Winter enough for joining me on this episode and sharing their truly inspiring stories about 13P. A big thanks to Rob Handel also for his support and encouragement. 13P undoubtedly changed the rulebook and set a precedent for playwrights everywhere to find agency and support in each other. Their achievements have certainly galvanized my determination to make my plays happen, and I hope you found the conversations encouraging too. While the published anthology, 13P The Complete Plays, seems to be out of print, the documentary, 13P A People's History, is still available to watch online on Vimeo, so I'll add a link to that in the show notes. Do check it out, it's well worth a watch.
Next time,
my conversation with the remarkable Winter Miller and the enduring spirit of 13P continues as we dive into the process of producing her play, No One Is Forgotten.
If what you really want is to make this show in this way and you can, you know, keep your sanity long enough to do it, great. You put something in the world that would not have been there. And no one can take that from you. And chances are people will respect you for having done the work and pushed, because it is a very brave thing to do. It's all on your shoulders.
Winter shares the challenges and triumphs of self-producing and directing the production, which premiered at Rattlestick Theatre in 2019, discussing the intricacies of bringing an off-Broadway play to life. All right, that's it. Until next time, stay inspired.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Writer's Toolkit podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave a review and share the link with your friends. This podcast is fueled by Ko-fi. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Ko-fi link in the show notes.